your oscilloscope might not show it to you. A properly adjusted spectrum analyzer easily. But those higher harmonics coming out of that switching regulator on that nasty piece of equipment in the room right alongside of your room, and he and you are on the same 120-volt line, and it might not even be the same one. There could be capacitive coupling between them. We won't go there yet. To resolve that particular undesired waveform, this particular test you're doing with the oscilloscope, properly done, is a positive definite, negative indefinite test. If you see something on that screen that shouldn't be there, and if it's really there, you've got something to investigate. If the screen shows you a beautiful, clean sine wave, you've passed the first step of your investigation, of your diagnosis. It could be a hell of a lot of 100 megacycle, 500 megacycle signals there that are too weak to show up on your particular oscilloscope, and yet giving some particular equipment in your room, giving you a lot of grief. So there's a lot more to the story than first meets the eye. Mel wants to give us some words on all this. K2KEY, I bet you've seen some noisy Con Ed lines in the factories you worked at, Mel. K2RIW and the TechNet.
And I had to come in.
Yeah, you're the third person. We haven't forgotten you. Go ahead, Mel.
Yes, this K2KEY, exactly. You're not going to see it on a simple oscilloscope measurement. The only thing is what you can do, if he's got a Tektronix scope, I will bet he has the, well, any of them have that time delay, you know, that you can stretch out and look at one take, you know, set up one sine wave. You can use the probe, that 10-to-1 probe that they come with. I'm sure he's got that 10-to-1 probe. That was a standard issue with any of the Tektronix scopes. And what you do is you clip the probe has the sticking off of the side of it, of course, the ground lead. Clip that to the plate or to the BX cable, and then you'll be able to look, you know, go directly onto the 110-volt hotline. And I don't think you're going to, like you say, see a heck of a lot. But that's one way to do it, and then expand it out using the time delay. But the more elegant way, of course, is a spectrum analyzer. And even a poor man's spectrum analyzer can tell you, I think, a heck of a lot more, Dick. Over.
Now, before Steve abandons his oscilloscope, and before he spends a whole lot of money buying a spectrum analyzer, there is one other thing he can do, and that is he can build an extremely simple high-pass filter network. He can take a 1 picofarad capacitor that has a 200 volt or higher voltage rating. He can take that 1 picofarad capacitor, connect it to his hot lead, while he's doubled on sure that his grounded lead of his scope probe is on the so-called return wire. Don't get that backwards. And then maybe he's going to put another shunt resistor to ground, but still, now he's got a kind of a high-pass filter. If, for instance, he's worried about whether or not the extraneous noise on his 120-volt line is 50 megacycles and higher, because he's running television sets and computers and whatever, and it's a higher frequency component, they will go through, roaring through that 1 picofarad capacitor like gangbusters, but the pure 60 cycles, which is many decades in frequency lower, very little of that will go through the 1 picofarad capacitor, particularly if he has the right kind of resistor at the far side of the 1 picofarad capacitor, like a 50 ohm resistor. In fact, on some oscilloscopes, you can use the oscilloscope, let me drop, you can use the oscilloscope in the 50 ohm termination mode and set the oscilloscope probe to the times 1 mode, not the times 10 mode. So now that the oscilloscope probe does present a 50 ohm load, but you're looking at your 120 volt line through a 1 picofarad capacitor, and we can do a calculation of what that high pass filter is. Maybe the answer is it's got a 3 dB roll off at 50 megacycles, but it's a high pass filter. Now he can turn the gain of the oscilloscope up 10 or 100 times higher, because it's no longer seeing the 60-cycle waveform per se. It's only looking at the higher frequency components in the frequency region he cares about, because that simple 1 picofarad capacitor is a high-pass filter. Now with the much higher gain on that oscilloscope, he can really see what voltage waveforms are there. Before we go over to Wesley, anyone got any comments on that approach for looking at noise on a 120-volt line? Give me your comments right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Why work with the 110-volt line? Why not stick a use a filament transformer? The same nonsense going on, I think. I don't think that'll filter out anything. Dick, would it be better to work with like a low voltage situation on the AC line?
It wouldn't be.
A good guess, Mel, but I say no. The laminations on your filament transformer are made to work at 60 cycles, and if you've got a real good brand, they're made to work up to 400 hertz. But those laminations are nowhere near as thin as they would have to be not to be creating eddy currents at 50 megacycles. Powdered iron core transformer could just barely do that. So an isolation transformer or a step-down voltage transformer most likely is not going to pass the, let's say, 100 megacycle extraneous signal on his 120-volt line that he's looking for. So I wouldn't, you've got to be very careful about choosing that transformer. So I think not. The simple 1 picofarad high-pass filter has something going for it. And maybe you're going to make it a 0.5 picofarad and recalculate, is the load resistor on the far side of the 1 picofarad going to be a 50 ohm or 1 ohm or whatever. But we can eventually make it so that if it's 100 megacycles of extraneous signal on his 120-volt line that he wants to find out, is it there or not there? By this very simple high-pass filter into his oscilloscope, he can get 20, 40, 60 decibels more sensitivity on that screen by the high-pass filter passing the signal he's looking for, but giving him lots of decibels of rejection of 60-cycle sine wave. I think I'm going to pass it over to you, Steve, to see if some of this makes some sense first before we go over to what Wesley wants to tell us. Over to you, Steve. KC2NDP, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Dick?
Go ahead, Eric.
I just wanted to point out that the scopes that I buy, because we work strictly in video, there's an option that we buy which actually has a low-pass and a high-pass filter on the input channel amplifier of the scope. So we always just throw it into high pass, and 60 hertz just doesn't pass through it. I just wanted to be clear about that.
Welcome to...
Yeah, that's a nice function to have. There's a 99% probability that Steve's scope doesn't do that. When you're in that high pass function, roughly what is the roll-off frequency is question number one. And also, we're talking about a relatively expensive oscilloscope here, aren't we, Eric? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, well, if you consider, $6,000-$7,000 relatively expensive, it's relatively expensive. The whole idea is to wipe out vertical and wipe out sync, so it actually rolls left to around 60 or 70 kilohertz before it starts to pass anything.
Okay, so that's a high-pass filter at 60 or 70 kilohertz. Very valuable in measuring noise on a 60-cycle line. By way of a RC simple network, I just gave you the simplest one-pole filter, a 1 picofarad capacitor into a 50-ohm resistor across your oscilloscope. That is a, and we can calculate exactly what that roll-off frequency is very easily. It's an RC, one over 2 pi RC, if you know what I mean, is the frequency response, the 3 dB roll-off frequency. We can make that so that it has only 1 dB of loss at the 100 meg of noise you're looking for, but it's got 40 dB of loss of 60 cycles. And if that's not enough of a frequency differentiation type high-pass filter, there's nothing stopping you from making two separate stages of that filter, a CRCR, and there's various kinds of filters we can build that will give you beautiful bandpass of the frequencies of noise you care about. I mean, if you're using a receiver that runs at 50 megacycles, you don't really care is there a 20 kilohertz extraneous signal there. You care about whether or not there's a 50 megacycle signal on your line. So by various very simple RC networks, you can force your oscilloscope to have 20, 40, 60 decibels more sensitivity at your frequency region, as opposed to the 60 hertz, which it will be rejecting, and therefore your oscilloscope that you own, Steve, can be a very poor man's kind of spectrum analyzer in this case. First of all, I'm going to pass it over to you, see if this makes some sense, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And KC2QAQ with a comment?
You're after Wesley. Yep. Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, yes, it all makes great sense. I'm sitting here taking it all in, and all great ideas. I will definitely try all these things. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, Mel. I was going to ask you the same thing as if I were to use a step-down transformer, but you say that's not a good idea. Now, Eric was mentioning isolation transformer. I can understand why he wants to use the isolation transformer because, you know, like you said, you can't put a hot and neutral. That's no problem with me. I've been in the business for 30 years. Is there any possibility of any of this line noise getting into the scope itself? You know, if I say, you know, I plug it into a problematic line, is there any possibility of the noise getting into the scope itself and creating all kinds of weird problems? Back to you.
There's a definite yes to that. First of all, a really well-made oscilloscope. It's vertical amplifier connected to that front panel BNC connector, for instance, going to your scope probe, should be a very well-shielded network. As such, he is only looking at the voltage you present to that BNC front panel connector by way of the oscilloscope probe, and he should reject everything else. If his power supply is doing a good job, the noise that's on the 110-volt line coming in, he should reject. But there's a catch. The catch is the plug for the oscilloscope that goes into the wall has three prongs to it, hot, return, and I'm going to call it the green safety wire, the round pin. The round pin is connected to the safety wiring of your house. Almost every house, even though you trace the wiring all the way back to the fuse panel, the safety wiring and the return wire eventually come to a common point at your fuse panel. But depending on what's going on in your particular house, depending on what nasty pieces of equipment are running in the adjacent room, your return wire that's in your laboratory and the safety wire, the green round plug that's in your laboratory, could easily have differential voltage across them. They both go back to the exact same fuse panel. And with a ohm meter, you would find a very small number of ohms. And you would think they're the same place. Not necessarily. You'd be amazed how many people have died in a hospital because of millivolts of difference between those two during a catheterization procedure. I won't go into that one right now. So isolation is really something important. So if you've got a nasty, let me drop. If you've got a really nasty piece of equipment in the adjacent room that's putting noise onto the return lead, and that return lead at high frequencies has a different amount of voltage compared to the safety round pin, the green one, and your oscilloscope is, its case is connected to the safety, and usually the BNC connector on the front panel, unless it's a very good oscilloscope, an expensive one, the BNC front panel is connected to the case of the oscilloscope. So it is directly connected to the safety wiring of the three-prong plug in the wall. But the return lead that you want to measure has another voltage on it, a high-frequency voltage. And now you connect the clip lead of the grounding of your oscilloscope probe to that return lead of the prog in your wall, and you're now putting a high-voltage current across the whole outer shield of your oscilloscope probe. And it's going to see voltages that are not really on the blade that you want to see. You're creating another source of currents flowing in there. That's one of the reasons why Eric likes to use an isolation transformer to make sure everything is really floating. But now the high frequency performance of that isolation transformer comes into question. As you can see, if you really want to make this measurement traceable to the Bureau, the right way to do it is with a dual channel oscilloscope in the A-B mode with proper calibration. And now it is, you can thoroughly differentiate, let me drop, with proper knowledge of a dual trace oscilloscope, a two-channel scope that has the A minus B function, or A, B negative inversion summed together, if you know what I mean, properly calibrated, you now can differentiate common mode extraneous voltages and differential mode extraneous voltages, and each of those done with these high-pass filters so that you look at the components, frequency region you care about, and reject the 60-cycle line. A very simple-sounding set of measurements you'd like to make, and now it's a function of how deep you want to go, as you can tell, Steve. There's more to it than first meets the eye. What else is new? I know that Wesley wants to add some things to this, and then Glenn in that order. Wesley, what else should we worry about here? N2XJN, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
N2XJN. Well, okay, quite a few things. At first, he forgot to mention that he's supposed to be cautious about which input he's, which channel he's using in the oscilloscope, because some of them, I have one oscilloscope that has five channels, and on channel one I have 400 volts peak to peak, but let's say on channel four I have 0.1 volt, so he will not burn the oscilloscope. And eventually it is good to use the probe with the proper divider on it, which is 10 to 1. I don't know if I'm using the proper wording, but everybody understands what I'm talking about. Now, as far as the insulation, well, the most of oscilloscopes, they have a transformer, which actually the two wires, the hot wire and the negative, goes to the primer of the transformer. The secondary goes to the electronics. And if you don't have, let's say, the ground on the oscilloscope, there is nothing that could go on it. And even if you have, I kind of cannot buy that you're going to have an oscilloscope affected by itself if you don't have a proper ground. It just doesn't come to me. Now, another thing that I have, let me drop, is that we're talking about low-pass filter, high-pass filter. I'm a little bit confused with that. This is the American wording, or this is the wording that I'm not used to in. The low-pass filter could represent, let's say, 52 ohms, 1.8 to 30 megahertz. What do we have, this 60 hertz that we worry about? The simple understanding of that we have a serious resonance circuit and parallel resonance circuit, and one of them is rejecting all of the frequency apart from one, and the other one is working reverse. So actually, if we reject only 60 hertz, we tune capacitor and the coil in the resonance circuit, which costs us $5, maybe $3 from the old junk that we have in the closet, then we don't have the 60 hertz, and we can see that. Let me drop. But you can also play, and I would love if Glenn and Eric correct me in this matter, if you play with the horizontal and the vertical, and actually you make the timing shorter, and then you actually make the wave invisible, and then you see almost a straight light, and everything that is on it, if you increase the amplitude on the oscilloscope, you're going to see a bunch of that stuff. As far as the Radio Shack 24DOS, the old frequency meter, you can also pick up the frequency, because what do you worry about? You worry about the electromagnetic interference, am I right? And to XJM.
A couple of words on what we're talking about here. A 1 picofarad capacitor used as a coupling network looking at a 60-cycle line. If I didn't do the math wrong, it's got an input impedance of 2.6 gigohms, not megohms, 2.6 thousand megohms. It's got a very high capacitor reactance. But when I use that 1 picofarad capacitor at 100 megacycles, it's got a more than a million to one ratio in its impedance. So with that 1 picofarad coupling capacitor, the but I just picked that number out of the air just to start off with. And Steve is capable of refining it to make it work exactly the way he wants to. But because the capacitor is a differentiating network, where it's more than a million times more sensitive to 60 megahertz than it is to 60 hertz. Therefore, the 60 megacycles that he might care about to find out if that extraneous signal is on his line affecting his receiving equipment at 60 megahertz, in my example, he now is a million to one, which is 60 decibels more sensitive to 60 megacycles than he is to 60 hertz. That's giving him a million to one more resolution capability on the oscilloscope screen. A high-pass filter with the American English, let me drop, is one that has a lot of rejection of signals at low frequency and almost no rejection of signals at a higher frequency. It is passing the higher frequencies. That's why we call it a high-pass filter. And a simple one-hole high-pass filter could be made out of a 1 picofarad coupling capacitor into a load of, let's say, 50 ohms. Well, we can refine these numbers, but I think you see the process. And that's just one stage, one-pole high-pass filter. And because it is so inexpensive, 1 picofarad and 50-ohm resistor, and very little voltage appears across his oscilloscope probe, he doesn't have to worry about using a times 10 probe, so to speak, because of the 60 cycles, it's being rejected by a million to one into his network because of the 1 picofarad capacitor. Only the high-frequency components he cares about are appearing on that scope screen, on that oscilloscope probe. So, and he can make multiple stages of this. So I think you see the process by which he can differentiate. I mean, the nicest way to do this is with a spectrum analyzer. But that's a $30,000 instrument to get a really good one. His oscilloscope that he owns with this very simple network can give him most of that measurement, in my opinion, with a little bit of extra smart data to it. I bet you've done things like this, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You're right on the money here, Dick. Just I wanted to add a couple more points that maybe we kind of glanced over a little bit here. One is that, you know, what's the proper location for the isolation transformer? Well, the right place to put it is at the power source for the oscilloscope or for the spectrum analyzer. Wherever you're going to plug the spectrum analyzer in, you want to isolate that. Let the oscilloscope or the spectrum analyzer float. Now, as far as the differential measurement, I kind of have a different opinion about that. Whenever I'm trying to measure this kind of noise on the power line, I agree with using some kind of stabilization network, whether it be a real LISN that's like FCC approved, which you can get a hold of, or one of the ones used for CISPR, the European standard from the IEC. You can use any one of those boxes that actually have all of those built in, and basically you just have a line one, line two switch, so you can look at each side of the line independently, and it takes off the low frequency, and it gives you a nice bandwidth between, say, like 100 kilohertz to about 100 megahertz, which is really where the spectrum of all the conducted emissions type of noise is going to bother and give you trouble when you let it drop. But I think the other thing here that's important to mention also is that you need some kind of loading. Generally, when you're measuring these kinds of emissions, you're using the LISN or the stabilization network on a device that's drawing power off the wall, and you're trying to measure its emissions. In this particular case, you're not trying to measure the device, you're trying to measure the wall. But in order to do that accurately, you need to scale some kind of load power. Like, generally, like I mentioned before, if you're using something like an LISN, you put a light bulb, something that you know has a very, very low noise attaching to the wall, so, and it's drawing some power and current from that wall outlet, and then you can make these measurements. A good thing to look at is Google's LISN, Line Impedance Stabilization Network. These are devices the way the FCC measures the power, the noise power coming out of the wall, and basically how to measure it. And you might get a better idea of understanding how these PI networks are isolating the 60 cycles, but allowing you to measure very, very accurately that spectrum of noise between 100 kilohertz to 100 megahertz. And also there again, try not to put any other additional filtering in between the measurement and your measuring device, whether it be in the oscilloscope or the spectrum analyzer. by putting the isolation transformer on the input, but be careful not to touch the case of, of your scope when you're making these measurements. One other note is typically I always use coax, like when I'm using the line impedance stabilization network. There's a BNC connector on one side. I use 50 ohm coax and either plug it into the spectrum analyzer or in this particular case into the oscilloscope. Back to you, the K2RIWKP2QIQ.
Just one quick question to Glenn. If you don't connect the ground cable, they use only two wire cable to power the oscilloscope. I don't believe the oscilloscope is going to be affected anyhow. It goes to the primer of the transformer. Glenn, back to you.
Well, I have a lot to say about that, Wesley. Yes, one reason that you want to have the isolation transformer on the oscilloscope or a battery powered oscilloscope, which would even be better, is that it's not just that you have the galvanized grounding problem that could give you an electrical shock or a short. The other problem that you have is that you have a return path in your measurement. One of the questions came in is, well, how will the noise affect the oscilloscope by bothering the oscilloscope or the spectrum analyzer? I've seen in many of these applications, you go into a good EMI lab, and when they're measuring conducted emissions, not only do they use an isolation transformer on the measuring device, between the measuring device and the utility power, but they'll also put some kind of an EMI filter in the power line between the oscilloscope to break up any current paths of noise that would sneak back into the wall through the measurement equipment. So it is important to really isolate the measurement equipment to get the best possible measurement. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, let me restate what I think Eric just told, Glenn just told us. If we set up this oscilloscope just right, so we're passing the high frequencies that are on your 110-volt line, and let's assume now that it's you've got two separate lines coming into your laboratory, and you want to know, is line A noisy, but your oscilloscope is being powered by line B. At the time you're measuring line A is not terminated by anything except your high-pass filter or your line impedance stabilization network, whatever. You can make a measurement, but that is essentially an open circuit measurement into a high-pass filter. And if the source of the noise is a relatively high impedance source of noise, and you measure a great big noisy voltage there, you could be alarmed, and maybe the alarm is a little bit unnecessary. Because when you now put a real load on there, like the 100-watt light bulb that Eric just mentioned, a 100-watt incandescent light bulb, a real load, because of the source of the noise has a high impedance component to it. And now you're loading down that 100 megacycle noise that you think you're measuring by the 100-watt light bulb, getting closer to the real way, the real world way that you're going to be using line A, the line that you're testing. All of a sudden, that noise may go down by 20 decibels, and it may not be alarming to you anymore. So even when you've got the right instrumentation, with the right kind of filtering, the right kind of gain, the right kind of isolation, the right kind of common mode rejection and whatever, you've done all these things right, do you want the line to be thoroughly unloaded during the measurement, which is worst case, or loaded in a realistic manner the way you're really going to use it? That's going to make some difference to the way you make a measurement, to the magnitude of the measurement you make. So, as I see it, I'd like to do it in the worst case. Let me drop. I would do it in the open circuit manner. If I see no noise, I'm happy. If I see some noise, the next step is to now create a load and find out how fast the noise disappears. I'm now doing half voltage method of measuring noise impedance. Not only the frequency of the noise and the magnitude of the noise, but what is the impedance of the noise? If the noise happens to be 100,000 ohm source 7 impedance at 100 megacycles, and I put a 1 ohm load across it, which is a 150 watt light bulb, and now it goes down by 30 decibels, what I thought was an alarming amount of noise might really be very tolerable, and I don't have to put forth a heroic effort to get rid of that noise. So it's nice to measure the noise in the most sensitive manner, open circuit, but don't become alarmed until you start loading it. Is some of what I think Glenn is saying. Glenn is saying a whole lot of other things. So you're getting more and more information on this that you never thought you were asking for, Steve. KC2, MDP, Dr. Picard, K2RIW in the TechNet.
2QIQ with one more thing to add.
Yeah, let me pick up Steve first, and then we'll go over to you, Glenn. Go ahead, Steve.
No, very good, Dick. You guys gave me plenty of homework assignments. You'll keep me busy for the next 2 weeks trying all this with the filter and trying it without the filter, trying it loading. Just one thing, you know, is with the isolation transformer and everything, how about just plugging my oscilloscope into a, you know, an uninterruptible power supply, you know, like a computer or something, and let it run on that while I do my tests. Do you think that it'd have any benefit for me? Back to you.
Comment.
Counter comment.
Yeah, when you run on one of these uninterruptible power supplies, which is an inverter circuit itself, and you unplug it from the wall, but your scope is plugged into it, and it's creating a quasi-square wave with an inverter running on its batteries. There's a slim possibility it makes some noise, and maybe that's one of the things that Eric's going to mention, and we're going to go to Wesley in that order. Eric, KE2EJ, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple things. Glenn, absolutely right. I put the isolation transformer on the piece of equipment, not the input. The isolation transformer will eliminate any high frequency. My goal is usually not to see RF, but 20, 30, 40, or 50 megahertz. Usually I'm looking for some kind of impulse noise or some kind of switching noise. We're pretty visible when you're doing common mode. And to Wesley, the fact that you're not using the ground clips on the probe, okay, which bothers you, think about when you take an EKG or anything that uses an instrumentation amplifier that has common noise rejection, alright? In essence, there are no ground clips, so to speak, and each individual lead by itself acts like an antenna. So when you're going into a differential input, it has a very significant amount of common mode rejection. So the reason why you normally connect a ground clip to your scope probe is to eliminate the floating stuff that would actually occur. You could use a UPS unplugged from the wall and just run on the battery to the UPS. By the way, today most UPSs produce a pretty good sine wave, but you know, maybe 1-2% distortion. So don't think of it as a square wave generator. The boxes themselves are usually very, very well encased. There's good Faraday cage around the stuff. There's big chokes on it going in and out. The EMI that comes out of it is very low. So back to you, Dick.
Okay, so that's one way of floating the scope. You could also temporarily, very carefully, use one of these gray isolating devices where it allows, you know, no, that wouldn't do it. That wouldn't do it. You'd end up cutting the round pin, and I don't want you to do that. So to isolate the safety wiring of the oscilloscope without damaging things, that's not easy. So the isolation transformer on the oscilloscope is worth considering. But I like the idea of the UPS. And the fact that they put out a nearly pure sine wave. But yeah, I think Glenn and Wesley wants to make some further comments on this. Glenn first, go ahead.
Yeah, just one more thing about the discussion about, let's see, differential mode and common mode noise in conducted emissions. You had mentioned before that the worst case, which sounds good, it would be at no load, because at no load, differential impedance is very, very high, and you're measuring an open circuit voltage, and you would expect that to be the noisiest condition and the most problematic with devices that are connected to a power line. Unfortunately, that's not the case. And you're going to laugh at me and say, well, that's obviously where the voltage is going to be the highest, right? That's where I would see the most noise. It really isn't. And with experience, and you measure this enough times, what you'll find out is the loaded, that's the worst case, because when you have a load connected across the differential input, it's the common mode that causes the most interference with devices connected up to a power line. And what does that all mean? What am I really trying to say here? What's happening is, if you look at the electronics, normally there's a power supply inside. It has a rectifier. It has a transformer. It has some LC filters, something for the differential, and a regulator. So the differential noise itself is being filtered down just by the power supply or whatever it is, the internal electronics of the device that's plugged into the wall. It's got tons and tons of differential rejection by the time it gets down to the electronic circuit. But now let's talk about the common mode interference between whatever the ground plane is in the device that you have and the voltages that are different, that are common mode to the power line, but they're not common mode to the output load side of whatever piece of equipment that you're using. the only real way to really get a good idea of that is to put a good load on the other side deck with an LISN and pull some power out of that wall outlet and then view that common mode noise. Because that's what's going to be floating on the chassis of your device and causing, especially for receivers, all kinds of noise. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, you got a good point here. I could have a safe looking line that with proper loading of my receiver, with my proper loading of my receiver, the differential mode looks small. My scanner, my IC R7000 is pretty happy, but the common mode voltage being put onto the bypass capacitors that are on the input filter network of my receiver, my scanner, is putting a common mode signal onto the chassis of my scanner. That chassis in turn has got a coaxial cable going to an antenna outside, and I'm impressing those common mode voltages onto that coaxial cable, which can very easily end up coming down that antenna. Now, is there an opportunity,
Ernie, and
is there an opportunity that you know of, Glenn, by which I put a differential load onto the line and the common mode voltage increases because I did that? Over to you, Glenn.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. That's generally how it's observed. If you take an unloaded wall outlet, the common mode currents are virtually canceled at the wall outlet. They're almost impossible to measure. When you start drawing a differential load across there, that's when they become very, very obvious, and you can see them, and they become highly amplified. Follow me on what I'm saying here, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
If the filter network on the input end of my load has an extremely small impedance to, let's say, 50 megacycles, so now that the hot lead and the return lead have this god-awful sized capacitor between the two, forcing whatever common mode that was there to still be there. I haven't changed the common mode voltage unless there is another capacitor between my input filter network of my load and its safety grounding. If there was no capacitor there, if my loading is thoroughly floating in a differential manner, the fact that I've created a differential load and I previously had common mode 100 megacycles in phase on both the hot lead and the return lead, and I didn't create a common mode load, I only created a differential load, what is the mechanism by which that circuit that I just described would change the amount of common mode undesired high frequency voltage? Over to you, Glenn.
Okay. The way that you're measuring and the technique that you're using for measuring a device that's producing noise is 100% accurate. That's not what you're measuring here. What you're measuring is the wall outlet. And what's on the wall outlet is other devices. You've got things plugged into the wall. You've got amplifiers and microwaves and cellular telephones and wall warts and everything plugged into that wall outlet, which is setting up a whole cornucopia of impedances, okay, to that wall outlet. Some of which are balanced by the time that you're measuring them. Until you pull the offset current through the wall, you'll never be able to measure the true offset currents or the common mode noise in the wall. Do you follow me now, Dick?
Yes, I am. As I put a differential load on my hot and return, the line drop on each of those leads changes. That can really easily upset the magnitudes and phase angles of the common mode high frequency voltage. Is that part of what you're saying?
Give that man a cigar. You're right on the money with that. That's exactly what it is. Because when you're trying to measure differential noise on a wall outlet, and you're making a measurement on one side and on the other side, L1 and L2, you'll be surprised at how with an LISN, even though you have it backwards facing the wall, and you're trying to measure each side, you'll measure that it'll look like a flat line. You'll be like, why can't I measure this noise? It should be there. And then you start loading it, and you're like, oh, my load must be noisy. And until you use a real pure load, and you start pulling it off there, and then you'll see the differences in line one and line two. and you'll actually measure one on each side and the amplitude, and you'll find out that in most cases, the more load you pull, the more noise you're going to see. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. And that's why it's also important to scale the load to the type of device that you would use on that wall outlet. If you know that your circuit breaker over there is like a 5 amp or something like that, I may want to load it to 5. If it's a 10 or 15, load it to 15. If you realize in that outlet you're only going to be using a receiver that's only going to be pulling like less than an amp or two, or, you know, under 200 watts, and, you know, size it to, like, that's why I tried to use the example of a 100-watt light bulb.
I'm beginning to think that the only way this reading that Steve is about to make will have complete meaning is if it's what medical people would call an in situ measurement. In other words, in the living organism under working conditions. If ordinarily on line A, the one he's measuring, has a couple of wall warts, a computer, a UPS, and whatever, in theory, he should put all of those things in the normal conditions as the load on line A when he makes these measurements of common mode and differential high-frequency voltages present on line A. That's the way he really intends to use it. That's the way he cares about it most. And maybe that's the way he's got to make it, an in-situ measurement. What do you think, Glenn?
I agree. And also, I'll add another step to that one as well. What you can do is you can do what I call the hot measurement. In other words, everything's plugged in, and you look at all the gobbledygook that's on there. And then what you can do is, one by one, start unplugging things and seeing how much things change. And then you can do another measurement where you try to unplug every possible thing you can in the house to see what the clean measurement looks like. And then you can get an idea between, as you plug in each device one by one, which ones are noisier than others, and do they really affect the equipment that you have? Because many times the equipment that we have is designed with CE standards to reject a lot of this noise, because it's just, you have to live with it. There's so much of it out there. Hopefully most of them are meeting FCC Class A or Class B to be better, Class B for, you know, devices used inside the house. Most of them usually do meet that. But the levels are still pretty high, even for Level B. You'd be surprised. You know, still, you know, 20 and 30 dB microvolts is nothing to sneeze at, but that's, you know, what's allowable. But, you know, when you make these kinds of measurements, and you get a better feel, you know, as you start plugging in and unplugging things and then seeing what kind of changes you have and, you know, which kind of devices are the ones that cause the most kinds of problems. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Zeke, for a moment, I have a question for Glenn. You say you with your oscilloscope on one outlet when you have the light bulb, and then you start plugging other devices. They're in the same circuitry, on the same circuit breaker. How should I understand that, Beck?
WB2HWW.
Recognized. Wesley, what I'm talking about here is when I'm taking my measurement, I'm measuring an outlet. In other words, we have an outlet that we're plugging into. That's the sample test. We're trying to find out that outlet, what kind of noise is on it. So what we're going to do is we're going to plug a 100-watt light bulb on that outlet under test. All of the other devices are what we're calling the unknown noise sources, the wall warts, the TVs, the microwaves, and everything else that's plugged into it. So in other words, we're just giving a nominal load to the wall outlet so we can make a measurement. First, let me pass it back to Dick, K2RIW, KC2QIQ, and then pick up Howie, I guess.
Pick up Bernie. Bernie, you want to make some words? Go ahead. Maybe not. Steve, I hope we're not scaring you with all this. We're making it sound like this is a homework assignment that's going to take a lifetime. I'm kind of curious, though, Steve. Is this an academic measurement where you just like to know how it would be done and whether or not you got a clean line? Or do you have a particular source of noise that's giving you grief and you'd like to pin it down? KC2MDP, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick. Well, actually, I've run into this problem a lot on the job where, you know, you get this line noise. A lot of it is from compact fluorescence. Some of it is from switching power supplies and these low voltage fixtures they're making today. Some of it is dimmers, and it creates all kinds of havoc. We had, just for an example, we had one customer that they have, you know, it's basically a restaurant, and they have this whole computer system in there, you know, for the waiters and the waitresses and stuff. And, you know, it's basically a touch screen and everything else. And they put all this fancy lighting in this place. And as soon as they go to use the lighting, it locks the computer up. And, you know, it took us a while to figure out what was going on there. And there are other houses where we basically, like, use this, what they call, it's like automated home controls. But basically, it's a series of touch switches. Let it drop for a second. It's like I said, it's basically a set of like touch switches. And basically, it just uses an RF frequency over the home wiring, and we run into all kinds of problems there too. With you know, same thing, motors, fluorescence, it could be anything. And, you know, you call the company that manufactures this stuff, and it say, oh, it could be anything from a computer to a pool pump. And, you know, you can never get a straight answer from them. So, you know, I'm kind of trying to enlighten myself and at least try and identify some of this noise. And I could say, well, you know what, this here, I get this, you know, this sine wave, let's say, for sake of argument, on my oscilloscope from a compact fluorescent, or I get this other one from a motor or something. I'm just trying to, like, enlighten myself on how I could find these problems, troubleshoot them, and eliminate the problems. Back to you.
E-White.
Mel recognized. We're going to go to you right after Howie. And that is, you definitely want to talk to Andy, the B2CDL. When I was at his house, he demonstrated to me that he installed in his basement recessed lighting with a dimmer circuit. And it's a reasonably good brand that he bought. And when he turns it on, his scanner receiver goes crazy. I think the noise lifts by, you know, 3S units or 4S units. So his particular brand of recessed lighting, and I think it was a electronic ballast type fluorescent lighting, but I'm not sure. But he ran into a very serious problem where he either can't turn on his recessed lighting in his laboratory in his basement, or he's going to have to thoroughly replace it because of the noise it makes. So there are certain respected brands of recessed lighting that can make some god-awful noise. And he's tackling that problem right now. So you and he are kindred spirits on this one, Steve. Howie, go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW in the Tech Man.
The question is not on this subject. If you have like 2 minutes before the net ends, I'd just like to ask you a quick question, Dick.
Okay, we'll hang on a little bit after the net to pick that one up. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Very good book for Steve. It's called Interference. It's put out by the ARRL, and it says how to find it and fix it, and in there they've got documented everything from brush motors and neon signs and RF circuits and you name it. Every kind of interference that's ever been reported to the ARRL has been documented in this manual, how to find it, how to fix it, how to design filters, what filters to buy. You can purchase that are commercially made, what they'll do, what they won't do, how they test them in the laboratory at the ARRL to see if they do have effectiveness for this particular interference problem. It's all in the manual. I have it right in front of me. It's a couple hundred pages. A phenomenally good documentation, everything from AC lines to automobile type interference, computers, you name it, Dick, it's in that book, over.
And typical of ARRL, is that roughly a $20 book, Mel? Go ahead.
$18, exactly.
A metal box with a liquid crystal display on it with the antenna. It was kind of the frequency meter for the incoming frequency. When you put it close to any interfering device, you could read the frequency. Do you remember that device?
And no, I don't, but that's a good one to look for. But the suggestion I got for you, Steve, I can see that you need this in your business. And you own an oscilloscope that you're willing to carry to your place of business to do analysis. You're eventually going to set up the right way of setting up scope probes, the right way of plugging into a three-prong wall plug on circuit A, then circuit B, and then circuit C, and looking for noise. So when you build the filter, when you set up the scope just right, and you're ready to make these measurements, I strongly recommend that you get together with Andy. You go to his particular house. You plug it into his particular line that powers his recessed lighting that's in his basement right now. And you look at what that noise looks like that is bombing the 11th daylights out of his any of his receivers, his radio receivers in that laboratory. And therefore, you'll get a beautiful way of practicing under real working conditions with a real noisy line and find out at least what that particular brand of recessed lighting with a dimmer circuit is capable of doing. And by the time you and Andy finish knocking your heads together and figuring out what you see on that screen and how to best assess it and how to put a magnitude on it, I think you, Andy, and us are all going to get a lot smarter. I think you should at least consider that approach, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a suggestion.
Yeah, Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, I'd be glad to share any information that that I could figure out. Yeah, it sounds that problem sounds all too familiar. We had a similar situation too, where we did a basement with the electronic ballasted fluorescent fixtures, and as soon as you turn those lights on, all radio reception in the basement, forget about it. You can even have an FM radio down there, you know. The thing would be playing fine, and as soon as you hit those lights, it just wiped it completely out.
I've heard stories of compact fluorescent light bulbs making some really bad noise, certain brand names, and certain failure mechanisms. I've heard about it happening with electronic ballasts that run at numbers like 50 kilohertz of switching rate. I've heard about it with just faulty fluorescent lighting. I've heard about it with dimmer circuits. Any of these things with silicon controlled rectifiers, pulse width modulation, phase operated controls and whatever, where they make bursts of noise at the switching frequency. They can make bursts of noise at 120 hertz as they turn on and turn off for their dimmer circuit. And so you're eventually going to find out that if your client is about to install brand A versus brand B of lighting, dimmers, compact fluorescents, AC ballasts, and whatever, there are certain brands you're eventually going to find out are known to be troublesome. You're going to make yourself a list, and maybe some smart company out there has already made a list as to how bad the noise is out of some of these brands, and how they pass FCC requirements is a darn interesting question. Maybe Glenn's going to tell us that some of them are not needing FCC or FCE or any of these other worldwide specifications. I'll bet you there are a zillion brands out there that are known to be pretty bad. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, you said a mouthful there, Dick. You know, unfortunately tonight we're only talking about half the situation. We're talking about conducted emissions. That's what was the title of discussion tonight. Try not to get off topic. But the other half to this one is called the radiated emissions. Now, here's the thing to this. Yes, the FCC and IEC, and they have a whole bunch of, you know, the FCC being a governing body, the IEC is basically just a regulation standard for Europe. But, you know, they do have a level. And, you know, there's like 30 dB microvolts. But what that measurement is, it tells you what the noise is on one device into a low impedance power line. That's all that it is, and that's all that you have to need. So when you have a real-life application where you've got devices plugged in all over the place, each one's meeting its standard, all of a sudden you don't have anything, there's no regulation to interreaction between other equipment. Let me let it drop. So the thing is, the noise is here, it's here to stay. Now the thing is, how do you make it work around the noise? Well, there's ways of doing that. One of the nice things that I love doing here, I do it in my ham shack, I do it wherever I'm taking measurements off. On the piece of equipment that you want to use that could be susceptible to noise, add an additional common mode filter to its power line, to where it's connected. Usually, another thing too is sometimes if you have a device that runs on battery power or AC power, try and see if just going to battery power alone fixes the problem. If it is, you know it's coming conducted through the power line. If it is, a good common mode filter in the power line, and make sure you don't have a lot of ground. Use one ground. You have the protective earth ground in your wall outlet. That's the third pin ground. make sure that that ground feeds through the common mode filter over to your device. And that will clean up a ton of interference problems with receivers. Let me let it drop one more time and focus on the radiated. As far as the radiated emissions go, well, if you've got a scanner or a low an HF receiver or something inside that's getting bothered by a lot of noise, that doesn't matter what you do to the power line anymore, it's filtered well enough and it's not coming through there. It's actually coming through the antenna and into the input. Well, the next thing is to feed your coax. Check your coax lines going in and out of your facility. Get your antenna and your signal-to-noise ratio up and get it above that noise floor. It's another very, very good way of handling that problem, is piping all of your signals in and out of your shack between your receiver and up to your antenna. It takes care of a tremendous amount of noise problems that might be in the local area. Now, let me pass back to you, Dick. I said a lot here. KQRIW, KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, I've got a real heavy question for you here, Glenn. I'm now putting myself in Steve's shoes. He's been called in to do electrical contracting and improvement. He discovers that certain pieces of equipment that are in the facility that he's about to do the contracting have strong incompatibility. The computer fails when the lighting is turned on. And so, yeah, simplistically you can say, well, don't use the lighting. Or he could say, well, you're going to have to remove all of that $100,000 worth of lighting you've just installed and reinstall. And if Steve said those words, he's going to be very unpopular. He's giving an extremely unhappy customer a piece of information, a piece of news he doesn't want. Is there any slightly simplistic solution to this? In other words, if he finds out, for instance, that the recessed lighting with its electronic ballast and with its dimmer circuit is a strong source of conducted noise, not radiated noise, let's hope.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
He discovers that he does a diagnosis. He discovers that that is the source of the noise, and that receives its power way back at the main fuse panel. Is there any kind of a filter that's not $1 zillion in price that he could add so that at least the conducted noise from that particular piece of equipment back to the rest of the wiring of the building could be isolated by, let me pick a number, 15 dB? I mean, is there a slightly more glamorous fix that's not $1 zillion? I mean, if he tells the customer he has no choice but to replace all of that very expensive wiring that they just put in, he's going to become very unpopular. Is there any other way you know of that he can correct the problem without spending $1 zillion? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Dick, can I say something?
Now, Glenn first and then Mel in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
Absolutely, Dick. I think I probably just wasn't being clear enough. But if you have a piece of equipment that's being interfered by conducted emissions, in most cases, that probably makes a mistake to put a device in one of those receivers. As I said, you have to worry about more with the radiated by bringing the antenna out of the building. But on conducted emissions, where you're picking up, you know, like fluorescent lighting, upsetting a computer or some other piece of measurement equipment, usually it's just a matter of isolating the wall outlet. So the two ways of really taking care of that situation is to make sure that all the grounding of all the equipment is on that's being bothered is all on the same ground, especially if it's like a system of a couple of things. Try to get them all on the same ground as possible. Then the next thing to do is to isolate the wall outlet with a common mode filter. You can build them at a ferrite, build common mode isolation, and with a couple of very, very small Y-caps, something like, you know, 0.01 from each line to chassis.
Welcome
and
to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system.
That's the perfect
sound
of that very thin wire in the wall outlet.
And
make that return all in one spot in that common mode filter. Now, you can make your own common mode filters with toroids and wind them up and a couple of, you know, 0.01s, or you can go to companies like Schaffner and you can buy pre-made filters that are good to like 15 amps and they'll give you as much as like 30 and 40 dB of attenuation depth. K2RIW,
K2QIQ. Yeah, Steve was doing this in his own home. To make a homebrew filter, no problem. But in his contracting business, for him to make a homebrew filter, oh, that's way out of line, in my opinion. So Schaffter is one of the companies that will make a filter that's got 20 decibels of conducted EMI rejection. He can put it on the source of the noise, and therefore the victim